Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches. And that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on our social media platforms at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now Jim Andrews continues his current study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of not only the books that I have authored, but some articles that I have written. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, that's one word, jimandrewsbooks.com, you will find there information describing the books I have authored, one of them co-authored with my daughter. In fact, that book, The Finality of Jesus Christ, is not a long book, but it's a very important book, and if anybody will let the Scriptures answer their questions about whether there are many ways to God, this will be decisive. Another very important book I've written is Polishing God's Monuments, Pillars of Hope for Punishing Times. I've written a book on marriage. Should help a lot of people if both are serious about walking with God in their marriage. Marriage Without Remorse, Rules for the Road. And finally, one about the pastoral ministry would be good for elders and leaders, too. Dispatches from the Front Lines, Reflections on the Glory and Grind of Pastoral Ministry. On top of that, on the same website, you'll see a tab that says Articles. If you will open that with your cursor, you will discover there are some articles that I've produced over the years that you may find interesting and helpful. For example, one of the most recent articles was my take on the demise of the culture wars and where I think we ought to go from here. Another article that appeared several years ago in a journal for biblical manhood and womanhood is entitled Boundaries Without Bonds. Another is a rebuttal of a tract that appeared several years back. The author attempted cleverly, but as I will show unsuccessfully, to persuade us that the Scriptures do not condemn homosexual practice. After all, that has all been a misunderstanding. Well, there will be others, but I mentioned those three. I'm not a regular blogger, but when sometimes things pop up on my radar that I feel I would like to address in a thoughtful way, I will sometimes produce a longer article like some of these. So I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. We continue our exposition of 2 Samuel. We're in 2 Samuel chapter 16 right now. We continue this long narrative recounting the trials and tribulations of David in the wake of the treasonous act of his son Absalom seeking to take over the throne and to kill David and his followers. David is now descending the other side of the Mount of Olives in an orderly retreat after much haste in getting out of the central city. He's first run into Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, and now he runs into an ugly situation. We read that when David came to Bahurim, behold, there came out from there a man of the family of the house of Saul, a Saulite. His name was Shimei, the son of Gera, a very bitter man. He came out cursing continually as he came because he held David responsible for all of the demise, the bloody demise, of the house of Saul. He just assumed that the hand of David was behind all of these deaths, political murders. He was quite wrong, but it was so regular in the politics of that day that nothing could persuade him otherwise. And as he saw David having to get out of Dodge, so to speak, walking through a defile, he's on the mountainside. He curses David and says, get out, you man of bloodshed, you worthless fellow, you dirty dog. The Lord has returned upon you all the bloodshed of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. Completely false charge, but you can't convince Shimei of that. The Lord has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom, and behold, you are taken in your own evil. For you are a man of bloodshed, you murderous creep, is the idea. Well, that's pretty hard for David to take. It's always hard to take that kind of thing when it's coming from people who don't know what they're talking about. They're hurling abuse, making allegations that don't hold water. We talked a bit about that, quite a bit about that in application, but I wanted to say something else before we move on from this. If you're a faithful pastor and a conscientious Christian leader, remember this, and we see it in play here in David as he flees from Absalom. Satan wants to knock you out of the box. The devil will bide his time until a favorable season. One day there's a spark of something. It hits dry tinder, and it flames up, and suddenly you have an inferno, and you're in the middle of it. It does not happen all the time, but very few real servants of God avoid it all the time either. All the prophets, all the apostles that we know anything about, not to mention our Lord Jesus Christ, they suffered in the work. I remember a pastor friend of mine. I went to college with him. He majored in chemical engineering, and long after I'd gone to seminary and come out of seminary pastoring, he was living in New Orleans, attending a church when God called him to leave his engineering job and go into the ministry. And he followed me to the same seminary and came out. It's a solid man. After he'd been in the ministry 30 years and had a good, sound ministry, a good run, I was going down there to meet up with him to go to a Bible conference where I would be teaching in the Gulfport, Biloxi area. And I found him uncharacteristically down. And I asked him about it, and his life was filled with pastoral troubles. He told me, he said, "You know, Jim," he said, "I pastored for 30 years, and I'd hear of all these pastors having these troubles." And he said, "I just thought they didn't know how to manage a church." And then one day, he got sidewise with two couples in his church who decided, like Shimei, to make him pay. It was over something ridiculous, and they had just declared war on him. And it just broke his heart, and I think in the end, his spirit. And shortly thereafter, he resigned. But you will learn that, like Shimei, people either believe lies all too readily, or they will tell them, or both. Usually it's both. They believe lies easily, and they tell them easily. Consequently, as I said in my last segment, truth is the first casualty of war, as they say, even church wars. Some people who turn on you, like Shimei, are mad about something, and they're ready to believe the worst and broadcast the worst, and will have no compunction about slandering your character and misrepresenting your actions from here to kingdom come. And listen, there is no defense, for they want to believe, for whatever reasons, what they are saying. And they need such excuses for their actions in order to justify themselves to their own consciences and to others that they're trying to pull in to the chaos. It's amazing how they can do these things and invoke God's name and God's blessing upon them. But if you read church history, you see it all the time. You could, if it were possible, produce voluminous FBI and CIA reports totally exonerating you of all allegations. But you know something? It would not make one whit of difference to the Shimeis in these situations. It's particularly galling when your enemies try to put a pious face on their opposition and slanders. But remember this. In these circumstances, your defense is God. You wait on the Lord. Don't bail, and chances are you will prevail. David did, as we're about to see. At times, David is not at his best. It cannot escape us that he's really not on his game as before. But now we are about to see the real David that we all know and love in his reaction to this vile character, Shimei. What Shimei was doing was very, very wrong. Eventually, there'll be accountability. But right now, he was abusing verbally the man God chose to be the king of Israel. And when you do that, my dear friends, you are despising the sacred, because David, not as an individual, but in his place and appointment by God, he was sacred territory. To insult and defame a man of God is to insult and defame the God who chooses him, and God chose David. He was slandering David. He was slandering God's viceroy of Israel. God's. The facts were not the facts. And no matter how much Shimei may have believed his version of events, he was wrong. He was dead wrong. and he was irresponsible in broadcasting his warped view of David and David's actions. Friends, I cannot tell you this strongly enough. It is always a serious matter before the Lord to slander and to treat abusively any of God's servants. It is especially evil to do it to any servant of God whom the Lord himself has chosen, appointed, and put in a position of responsibility. Now, don't mishear me. I do not say God's servants, when they do wrong, are to be given a pass. What I say is that, one, before you start running them down and broadcasting slander like Shimei, you had better be right or face the consequences. You better be right. And even if you are right in your low opinions of some Christian leader, hear me, there is a wrong way and there is a right way to seek their removal. If you do it the wrong way, you make yourself as bad as you think them to be, and you share their same accountability. What Shimei did was, by the rules of the time, a capital offense. David's mighty men, including David's relative, Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, on this occasion just begged for the privilege of riding up on that hill and lifting the head of Shimei from his shoulders. He says to David, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over now and cut off his head." In verse 10, David restrained his bloodlust. "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah?" Which was a way of saying, guys, we are not on the same page here. If he curses, and if the Lord has told him, curse David, then who will say, why have you done so? Now, here's what David means. David attributes Shimei's actions to divine direction. God does not make people sin or do wrong, but he means it in this sense. He means that God had given sovereign permission or license for Shimei to vent himself in this wicked way, and in doing so, in giving that permission and not restraining him, God had tested David's human reaction. Shimei has this evil disposition all on his own. God didn't put it there. Shimei was pulling on his leash like a rabid dog to bite David viciously. As happened to Job, when the Lord gave the devil, with the devil's malicious intent, permission to savage Job, so here David sees the Lord giving Shimei permission to act out, but all for the purpose of testing David's response, and this brings Shimei ultimately to self-destruction, which the man so richly deserved. Again, God does not do evil, nor does God implant evil in the minds of others. But God does, when it suits his purposes, give evil dispositions a free rein to do their evil deeds so that he might bring those people into judgment and test his own people through their assaults. So here. So in verse 11, David does not excuse the conduct of Shimei, but he minimizes his conduct compared to Absalom. David says, "You think this is bad, what Shimei's doing? He's just mouthing off and throwing stones. Behold, my son, who came out of me, seeks my life. How much more this Benjaminite of the tribe of Saul? Let him alone. Let him curse, for the Lord has told him to do it." Told him in the sense that someone in authority might see a perfect fool determined to engage in his folly and say to him, "Go ahead. That's what you want to do? Do it." And then turn around and use his folly for a teachable moment. Something like that is going on here. Well, in verse 12, here is the meekness of David in full flower. You've heard it before. Do not confuse meekness with weakness. This is the king humbly bowing to whatever his sovereign God has in mind in David's humiliation. David says, "Perhaps the Lord will look upon my affliction." That is, I paraphrase, if I don't take matters into my own hand and seek my own royal vengeance, perhaps the Lord will look upon my affliction. He'll be merciful. He'll return good to me instead of his cursing this day. In other words, David sees the possibility that God will nullify his curses and bring upon me his blessing if I respond humbly rather than proudly as king in this situation. So in verses 13 through 14, patiently, David and his retinue continued on their path. Shimei continued to rail and hurl stones and abuse as he followed them, walking parallel along the mountainside, with no one lifting a hand to put a stop to it. Finally, David's party arrives at the fords of the Jordan, where they give their weariness a rest. This was meekness in action. It took this form. David says, "The Lord sees, so I will not take my own revenge. Let the Lord deal with Shimei. Let the Lord in his mercy and compassion take my part." Folks, that's always the wise way to go when mean people are doing mean things to injure us. Now, when there are bigger stakes, as when national interests are involved, or church interests are at stake, or family interests are involved, we may be obliged to take action. It may be our responsibility as a leader. But the difference here is when these things are merely personal, it is better to accept humiliation, even if we possess the power to stop it, and better to leave it to the Lord than to exact our pound of flesh in retribution, even when we have the power to do so. Well, in verse 15, the narrator shifts the scene to Jerusalem. Absalom and his men make a triumphal entry to the city of Jerusalem. Ominously, it is noted that Ahithophel, David's counselor, is with Absalom, and that's supposed to tell us Absalom is in good hands. Absalom has a champion advisor at his side who knows exactly how to get the government firmly in Absalom's hands. The advice he gives Absalom is designed to illustrate just how shrewd Ahithophel is. But as we shall see, he's nowhere near as formidable as an old wise God who now works through human agency, and God will frustrate Ahithophel's wisdom and bring him and Absalom to ruin. Brings to mind Romans 8, when God is for us, who can be against us? There's not a wise man, there's not a group of wise men in the world, or mighty men, whose rules God cannot override and whose best laid plans God cannot frustrate. And we're about to see an example of that right here. You remember Hushai the Archite? He was one of those who met David as David was taking flight to Jerusalem. And David said, "You could help me more if you will go back to Jerusalem, and there you will pretend to transfer your loyalties to Absalom, my son, and be a mole, and spy on them, and let me know what counsel is being given to him." So Hushai the Archite, in response to David's plea, came to Absalom and disingenuously embraced him as Israel's new king. "Long live the king, long live the king," he proclaimed in words that could, in his own mind, apply to David. It's ambiguous. It's a classic case of double meaning. His words mean one thing to Absalom, who wanted to believe Hushai had come over to his side. But to Hushai, those words were his wish for David. He was shrewd in his choice of words, but not dishonest. You just had to be inside his mind to exegete the real meaning. It was a word game. He was here at David's behest to gather intelligence, as we said, about Absalom's plans on one hand. The intent was doing whatever possible to subvert the advice of Ahithophel, who in such matters had a reputation for being a dead-eyed dick, counsel-wise. But as savvy as Ahithophel was, he was no match for God. God will work through Hushai to thwart Absalom's taking the better counsel of Ahithophel in this instance. For Absalom, verse 18, the appearance of Hushai is an unexpected and curious blessing, or so he imagined. He already knew what grievance had caused Ahithophel to betray David. But now he wonders aloud why Hushai the Archite, quote, "did not go with your friend, namely David, when circumstances forced David to flee Jerusalem with his supporters." Well, in verse 19, not short on God-given wits himself, Hushai, quick on his feet, was ready with a convincing answer to Absalom. Absalom bought it, but what Absalom thought applied to him, really in Hushai's mind, applied to his father David. Here's what he said to Absalom. "Oh, no. For whom the Lord, this people, and all the men of Israel have chosen," earlier it had been David and remained so, "his I will be, and with him I will remain. And beside, whom should I serve? Should I not serve in the presence of his son as I served in your father's presence, so I will be in your presence?" And that's exactly what he was doing, being in Absalom's presence and serving David. It's so interesting how he managed to stick to the truth without boldly lying, though he did deliberately deceive the wicked Absalom. The whole scenario, which we must remember as being orchestrated by God through a human instrument, reminds me of Psalm 18:26. There it is written, "With the pure thou didst show thyself pure, with the crooked thou didst show thyself astute." And that's what God is doing through Hushai. God deals with each type according to his kind, and that very phenomenon is unfolding itself here. When I was in my first church, we had an old deacon who was a big, big problem, very cagey. He was about 75 when I came to the church. He had always kind of ruled it because about half the family was loosely related to him. The whole scene back there was kind of tribal. He had to go, but I had no way of getting rid of him. They didn't rotate on and off the board. They were lifetime deacons. One day, the Lord gave me a way to leverage his life appointment as chairman of the deacon board. And when that happened, I pulled the trigger. Long story, can't get into all that. He was upset. Had no reason to be. He himself set it up. Well, the deal was done. Then one or two of his buddies wanted to hold a big banquet to honor him for his years of faithful. That's a real stretch on that word, faithful service to the church. That, of course, put me in an awful spot, for I saw nothing honorable in the man, and what they were setting up would force me as a pastor to go before all those folk and lie through my teeth and make a hypocrite of myself and make a saint of such a sinner, for so I regarded him. So I wrote a little piece, a piece of faint praise. In it, I mentioned that more than anyone else, we owe the condition of the church when I came. That was true. And that he had been, over the years, the single most influential in the church for the last 50 years. And that was true. I just left it to the hearers to construe in a positive or negative manner as they viewed reality. Those very honest words. Sometimes we can say what is true without getting in trouble with the facts or our conscience. And the target of our words are none the wiser. Such was the case there, and that's what Hushai did here. To exemplify the shrewd counsel of Ahithophel and the threat he represented to David, his now enemy, we're told that Absalom gets to Jerusalem and smartly asks Ahithophel's advice right off the bat. His advice was to pitch a tent on the palace roof, have sexual relations with David's concubines left to keep house. That would be a political move, not a sexual move. That move would make a statement that Absalom had crossed the Rubicon. It would say that there was no turning back, no second thoughts that would put his followers at risk if Absalom suddenly got cold feet. And it was a fulfillment of prophecy. It was out in front of God and everybody read the signal, and his followers were strengthened by it. This specific counsel is cited here to illustrate Ahithophel's worldly wisdom and why he was held in such regard as a valued counselor to kings. But it's a foil for what God does. God, through Hushai, frustrates his good counsel, and he will bring him to a bitter end. For in Job it is written, God frustrates the plotting of the shrewd so that their hands cannot obtain success. God captures the wise by their own shrewdness, and the advice of the cunning is quickly thwarted. Job 5:12-13. In the book of Esther, we see that very reality play out as God thwarts the evil designs of the wicked Haman to destroy the Jews. Haman had it all lined up. He had all the power and permission he needed. The Jewish people were at his mercy, and the date for their destruction was written in stone. But the Lord God had already anticipated all of his savagery and set up circumstances to countermand his plot. The Lord first deliciously humiliated him before hoisting him on his own petard, so to speak. Sometimes in life we can find ourselves at that point. Our enemies have a commanding position. We feel helpless. The combat is unequal. They have the drop on us. The best assets are in their corner. We can't win even though we are not in the wrong. Take heart, friends. If you ever find yourself in such a crack, remember, right here the Lord is about to show what he is capable of doing when the enemy holds all the best cards. For as the Apostle Paul says, the foolishness of God is wiser than men. Never forget that. Well, that very thing is what we're about to see in chapter 17, which continues this narrative, despite the chapter break. Thank you, friends, for joining us on The Final Word. God bless you and have a wonderful day.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. Our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program has ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach. Be sure.